Welcome to the Intelligent Medicine Podcast. I'm your host, Dr. Ronald Hoffman, and once again, it's time to visit with one of our favorite guests, Hoffman Center nutritionist Layla Mutin. It's Q&A with Layla, and that's a feature that you seem to really like, judging from the feedback. We're getting lots of emails and people on Facebook sharing with us that they really enjoy these sessions where we do a little problem solving. So welcome once again, Layla.
Hi, Dr. Hoffman. Thank you.
It's my pleasure having you back on. And I have some really good news to share with you. Remember, last month we gave a progress report on the number of podcast downloads. I think we started out with 35,000, and then it got to be 50,000, then it got to be 60,000. We have now officially completed our 100th podcast. Can you believe it?
Oh, wow. Oh, my goodness.
Not you and me personally. I think we've probably done at least a dozen Q&As with you. But then I've done some individual podcasts, you know, where I talk about specific issues on my own. And then we've interviewed a lot of really great guests in 2013. And now beginning again in 2014, we have a great roster of guests.
Well, happy 100th podcast. That's wonderful.
It gets better, but it gets better. We reached 76,805 podcasts in October.
Wow.
And so then the question is it going to plateau? And we now have stats in for November. We're still awaiting the stats for December. But in November, I'm proud to say we had 90,896 podcast downloads.
Oh, my goodness.
So the growth looks like exponential, and we're reaching more and more people through these podcasts. People seem to be enjoying the podcasts.
That's wonderful news.
Hopefully we're getting the word out. And this is an opportunity for you to get your questions answered. You know, now I'm on the radio. You can call me, but there's limited time available to get your questions in. We have lots of people calling when I'm live on WR on Saturdays from 1 to 2. So you can email us your question to radioprogram@AOL.com, and that's where we get the questions for this Q&A session that I do with Layla every week here on the Intelligent Medicine Podcast. So we've got a bunch of questions, and we have an important announcement, because next week is a big week for us at the Hoffman Center. Tell us about that.
Yes, next week is our lecture on Wednesday, January 15, Menopause and Andropause. It begins at 6. It's from 6 to about 8 o'clock. You must reserve your seat, so please try to call us this week at 212-779-1744 to make your reservation.
Okay, and let me reframe that a little bit, because for a lot of people, they're going to go, okay, menopause, andropause. The special focus of this particular seminar, which I'm going to be very active in presenting along with you, Layla, is that doubts have been cast on the safety of testosterone for men. You know, you see the ads on TV, you know, low T, and you hear radio ads for if you feel, you know, like you're, you know, down in the mouth and not performing well in the sac, you may have low T, and, you know, there's a whole bunch of different products available to address low T. But now they're saying, you know, just like with supplements, they're saying, well, supplements could be dangerous. They're saying, don't take testosterone. Testosterone could be dangerous, could be bad for your heart. We're going to take a look at that proposition very critically. And I think those of you who are on the cusp, men, and, of course, the women who you rely upon for advice and trust and reinsurance, I think you're going to find this seminar very useful.
Yeah, absolutely. So we look forward to seeing you all there.
And so signing up is via?
Via telephone, 212-779-1744.
Okay, with apologies to our listeners in Mali and in our listeners in Czechoslovakia and Australia, you know, you won't be able to attend unless you get an economy plane fare in New York. It's very cold, so maybe they have special rates. Okay, so let's I got a couple questions. Let me start with a question that I have from, let's see what we have here. Hi, Dr. Hoffman and Layla. How are you? My wife is currently 8 weeks pregnant, and she is suffering from morning sickness. This is happening mostly at night. The symptoms have been occurring each night for approximately 3 weeks. My wife is of Chinese origin and is thin and maintains an exercise regime of 4 times 1 hour low-intensity exercise per week. Initial blood tests showed her vitamin D levels were low. All other nutrients tested were deemed to be at an appropriate level. She used to love to drink coffee and eat chicken, though now does not have the appetite for this. Well, that's pretty common during pregnancy. You know, whatever you like when you're not mm-hmm. pregnant, all of a sudden you'd find, you know, you don't care for it, and you have these weird cravings. He says his wife is craving Vegemite with toast as well as lots of soup. You know what Vegemite is?
No.
Vegemite is very popular in England and in Australia, you know, wherever English people hang out. And it is actually like a yeasty kind of spread for bread.
Huh.
It's very salty, so she may be satisfying her salt cravings. Mm-hmm. For those who have yeast sensitivity, it's probably not great. But anyway, you know, look, that's why women who are pregnant like saltine crackers. They tend to like salty taste. You know, they crave salt. Maybe they need more sodium because their blood pressure is low. All right, so what do we do for morning sickness.
Morning sickness. In her case, nighttime sickness. Morning sickness is common, especially during the first trimester.
Yep.
It's supposed to clear up by the 16th week of pregnancy. For those with hyperemesis, it doesn't. And I've known women personally who are ill until they give birth, which is really
And sometimes they literally have to be hospitalized to get intravenous because they can't keep anything down.
So
it's terrible.
Dehydrated. Yeah. I think a very, very good remedy, and I've recommended this to many people, is some fresh ginger tea.
Yeah.
Ginger is very good for nausea. I'm talking about taking fresh ginger, slicing it up into thin slices, putting that in the bottom of a mug, and pouring some boiling water over it.
Mm-hmm.
And just sipping it, maybe all day long, maybe with a little bit of lemon. That would be one thing. Another thing that helps with morning sickness is vitamin B6.
Absolutely, yeah.
Yeah. Some B6, and if you're taking a B6, there will be other B vitamins in a good prenatal formula as well. I think a dose of maybe 50 to 100 milligrams of B6, Dr. Hoffman, would you agree?
Yeah, no, that's
would
good.
Would probably be appropriate. Maybe some might even prescribe more than that.
Right.
And to help.
In cases where you're just so nauseous that you can't even take a B6 pill. I mean, that happens rarely, but some women are very nauseous. You can get the B vitamin injections. That actually can help.
Yeah.
Also, we might recommend C-bands. Those are the things that fishermen use to alleviate nausea. They help you press on an acupuncture point that's located near your wrist. And actually, there are pregnancy versions of those.
Wonderful.
Designed for pregnant women, or you can go to an acupuncturist. An acupuncturist would be even better because, you know, maybe a little more expensive, less convenient than self-administration of acupressure, but more effective for alleviating morning sickness. Yeah. There are certain points in acupuncture that are really good for nausea.
Mm.
And that's a very benign therapy. You know what the problem is with nausea pregnancy, they have used drugs in the past, like Bendectine, that have turned out to be very, very dangerous and toxic in pregnancy. So in an effort to alleviate the nausea, they've created much worse problems.
Yeah.
Now, most gynecologists will reassure women who have morning sickness that this is not necessarily a bad sign. There's actually a sign of a rather robust pregnancy.
Is that right?
Yes. If you have terrible morning sickness, you know, don't think something is wrong or that, you know, your child is going to turn out bad. Terrible morning sickness is a sign that you are having a very robust hormonal response to the pregnancy.
Mm-hmm.
And it's not necessarily bad. I mean, look, if you're vomiting all the time, you become dehydrated and you have to, you know, go into the hospital and get intravenous, that's another thing. That's called hyperemesis gravidum, which is a serious medical emergency. But, ordinary run-of-the-mill morning sickness, that's par for the course.
Yeah.
And may mean that you're going to have a healthy, bouncing baby, 9 months. Hence.
Yeah. Another thing that I would tell women who have a lot of morning sickness is to simply don't fret, but take advantage of the times that you are hungry and eat then, even if it's not a mealtime. And another thing is, for many women, it's the aroma of the food that tends to nauseate them.
Right.
So my recommendation would be to chill the food, to chill your chicken before you eat it so that you're not getting all of that aroma.
Right.
And other women don't realize that sometimes the nausea is alleviated by eating something a little bit bland. So maybe some rice or something like that. That might be helpful.
Ever see Rosemary's Baby?
Yes.
You remember
Mia
that scene
Farrow,
with Rosemary's
right?
Baby where she started to eat like raw liver? That was scary.
You know, I don't remember that part, but I remember it was terrifying.
You shut that out of your mind, but there's a scene in it where
I was a kid.
There's a scene in it where she's eating like bloody raw liver, and her husband gets home and sees this like the blood running, coursing down her chin, and realizes that something is probably terribly wrong. So if you tend to, clearly women might crave
all kinds of things. Well, that's an iron deficiency to me.
Exactly. That suggests iron deficiency.
Yeah.
Either it's iron, a serious case of iron deficiency, or else you're carrying the devil's spawn, one or the other. That's what that indicates.
Yeah.
All right. Let's move right along. You have another question?
Actually, I do. This is from Rose, and she writes, Dr. Hoffman, I have polyps, two or more, on my gallbladder. I have no pain. After eating anything, sometimes I get sick. Doctor suggests removing the gallbladder. I do not want to have surgery. Can you suggest any non-prescription remedies I can take?
Let me talk a little bit about gallbladder polyps, okay? Because gallbladder polyps they're like intestinal polyps. They're benign. And you can actually see them. They're visualized. You don't know that you have them unless your gallbladder gives you trouble. And then they visualize your gallbladder, usually using an ultrasound. And then you see the polyps. And they're growths. They're usually symmetrical, you know, so they don't look jagged or weird. So they don't look like cancer. Cancer of the gallbladder is a rather rare cancer, but it's a very dangerous cancer. If you have cancer of the gallbladder, it's really tough to treat. Polyps, by definition, are benign. It turns out that gallbladder polyps affect about 5% of the adult population. So if we looked at everybody, did a right upper quadrant ultrasound, and say, oh, look, you've got gallbladder polyps. Here's the problem. They're actually set up criteria for this. Is that most small polyps, less than a centimeter, which is, I guess, about a half an inch, are not cancerous, and they're fine. But they're sort of a cutoff, and I think that cutoff is 0.8 centimeters, where if the polyps are larger than that, they suggest that you get your gallbladder out. Now, you can't just go in and take the polyp. You just take your whole gallbladder out. And the reason for that is that, unfortunately, a very small percentage of these polyps may harbor cancer cells, and therefore it's preferable to nip it in the bud than allow it to grow and spread. Now, this, I mean, even if it's not bothering you, you know, it seems ridiculous to have your gallbladder taken out, but the concern is that, and medicine is, you know, a cautious science, you want to, in an abundance of caution, you may want to undertake the surgery. I cannot think of anything on God's earth that's going to make that polyp shrink, unfortunately.
Yeah, I can't either.
Right? No, right?
Honestly.
No
type of enzymes or anything, right?
No.
No, it's not.
So, unfortunately, this is a bit of a bind. I mean, you can, you know, the doctor's going to say, it's medically correct to have your gallbladder taken out. And you're going to say, why? And he's going to say, what I just said, there's a very small chance that there could be trouble lurking within that polyp. And you have a choice. You can say, look, yes, I will do that. Or you can say, look, I'm going to take my chances. It's very likely that it will cause you no trouble at all, that you'll happily go to your grave in 105 with gallbladder polyps. On the other hand, there is a very, very, very slight chance that there could be problems brewing within that polyp. And that's why, you know, that's another, you know, why people with intestinal polyps get, once you have a colonoscopy and you've had a polyp, they take it out, even though it looks fine, they take it out just to examine it and to slice it and dice it and make sure there's no cancer hiding within it. And then they recommend that you get a colonoscopy at more frequent intervals than if you never had a polyp to begin with, because polyps tend to recur.
Mm-hmm.
So that's the deal.
Okay.
Yeah.
So that's for Rose.
Yep.
Let me see. I have another question from Janet. She's actually a former patient, we think.
Okay.
Visited your office a few years ago, found that I have hypoglycemia. I understand this means low blood sugar. What does this mean in regard to my eating sweets? Also, I've been reading lately about
I guess she wasn't paying attention when she was in the office a few years ago. Maybe she really needs a refresher course. Come back in and we'll be happy to address that. But we'll be very forthcoming. We'll talk about it on the radio.
Yeah. Also, I've been reading lately about alpha-lipoic acid, which you recommended, and want to know if perhaps I should not be taking it. WebMD seems to advise this for my situation. WebMD.
I'm not sure what they advise. They advise to take it or not take it. Okay.
To not take it for her situation.
Okay, that's dumb.
Yeah.
So what do we, let's do that question backwards. You know, we'll talk about the alpha-lipoic acid if you have hypoglycemia.
Mm-hmm.
And then we'll talk a little more about hypoglycemia in general, shall we? But let's say if you have hypoglycemia, that means low blood sugar. Alpha-lipoic acid is something that helps to normalize blood sugar.
Mm-hmm.
me. It helps to, mm-hmm. if you have high blood sugar, prediabetes, it will help to optimize your blood sugar. It does so by improving insulin response. And,
it could also help with diabetic neuropathy.
Yeah, absolutely.
To some extent, yeah.
Right, absolutely. Yeah. No, there's no question. Mm-hmm. That's one of its major uses in Germany. They use it all the time as a medicine. In fact, you know, when I was in Germany, I was visiting a doctor's office and they had a drug salesman come by. And the drug salesman was, you know, selling all manner of pharmaceutical drugs. And they said, here, would you be interested in some of this? It's alpha-lipoic acid. It's going to be really good for your patients with diabetic neuropathy. This was back in the 1980s.
Mm-hmm.
They were using it in Germany as a medication, and therefore it was actually paid for by state medical insurance, socialized medicine over there as a medicine to be administered orally or intravenously. Now, here's the deal. If you administer it intravenously, which I do for some patients with severe neuropathy or liver disease, it's actually very, very helpful for severe liver disease. It was discovered as a means of treating very, very dangerous liver failure due to consumption of poison mushrooms. It actually can help to save the liver from complete liver failure and prevent the need for a liver transplant. So if you give it intravenously, that's what it can do. It has tremendous protective effects on the liver. So I always give it in patients with liver problems. Or I give it to patients with diabetic neuropathy. Those are some of the main reasons to give it. Intravenously, you got to be a little careful. I tell patients before getting it intravenously to make sure you eat, because it can lower blood sugar when given intravenously. But intravenous is different than oral. Oral administration of alpha-lipoic acid doesn't usually cause such a big lowering of blood sugar. It may lower blood sugar if your blood sugar is abnormally high, but it won't lower it more if your blood sugar is normal. Has that been your experience? Because a lot of people take it. I personally take alpha-lipoic mm-hmm. acid twice daily because it's a really important antioxidant to take. It's great for the brain, mm-hmm. too. I need my brain. I want to keep using it for another few decades.
That would be good, right?
Yeah, I mean, since I'm doing these podcasts and the show, I got to keep on my toes, right? So alpha-lipoic acid is part of my regimen, and I don't find that it promotes hypoglycemia.
I've not seen that either. I do believe that it should be supplemented with some B vitamins,
yes.
for some enhancement, but I've not seen any hypoglycemia with alpha-lipoic
right.
acid.
And we actually use a product for diabetes that contains alpha-lipoic acid. It's called Diaxanol. It's a very nice combination product. It's available from drhoffman.com. It's great.
Mm-hmm.
It's helped to normalize blood sugar. I got to say, we had really nice success yesterday. We saw a patient in common. I won't mention his name, but mm-hmm. he's a dentist. And he came in more than a year ago, and he actually had very poorly controlled diabetes. And I said, my goodness, your hemoglobin A1C is 8.8. It was quite high. And he said, well, can I fix it? And I said, well, you know, we're going to try diet and we're going to try supplements, but sometimes you do need a little medication. I warned him. I said, you know, I'm not 100% sure we can do this just with natural methods alone. Well, he was really steadfast about it. I mean, he's, as you know, he's following the diet perfectly. He eats, you know, virtually no excess carbohydrates. So he's on a grain-free diet. He's like fish, eggs, meat, lots of vegetables, but starch, low starch vegetables, doesn't cheat. Hardly ever a kid, maybe for his birthday, is like a, whatever, like a bagel or something. That's a, you know, so, and he takes the supplements, and he takes a CM Core, which is very good for diabetes. It's a berberine supplement.
Mm-hmm. He's taking a natural metformin.
Right, natural metformin.
Yeah.
And he's taking dioxinol, he's taking fish oil, he's taking magnesium, he's taking all these good things that have, dioxinol, of course, contains chromium and vanadium, and I think it also has Gymnema sylvestri, which is the Ayurvedic blood sugar agent.
Mm-hmm.
And lo and behold, he comes in. Not only does he have an alleviation of his diabetes, but he actually has one of the more perfect blood sugars that I see in the average patient who comes to the Hoffman Center.
Yeah, well.
He's gone from like, you know, a D minus to an A plus in his blood sugar control.
Well, that's what we do here. You know, we reverse type 2 diabetes.
Yeah.
Out in mainstream medicine, it is simply managed. You have to live with it.
Yep.
And oh my goodness, God forbid you don't eat a grain, you will die. And that is completely and blatantly incorrect.
Yeah.
So, you know, we're in the business of reversing diabetes here.
Yep.
This is what we do. That's one of the many conditions that we treat here at the Hoffman Center. I just want to say a little more about the hypoglycemia.
Sure, let's do it.
That this person is asking about when she says, what does this mean in regard to my eating sweets? Well, hypoglycemia, people think because it's low blood sugar that it's the opposite of diabetes, which is high blood sugar, but it's actually not. Hypoglycemia is like the pre-diabetes because that's the beginning of unstable blood sugar.
Yep.
The ups and the downs, the highs and the lows. And what happens when we eat sweets is we send our blood sugar screaming high into the stratosphere, and then our pancreas is given the task of secreting a whole lot of insulin to bring that blood sugar back to normal. But if we're eating like this frequently, it will overshoot and secrete a whole lot more insulin and will cause the blood sugar to crash, aka hypoglycemia or low blood sugar.
Yes.
If we keep on with this erratic blood sugar for, a decade or two, this can eventually lead to prediabetes as well as to diabetes. And then when we become really late stage diabetics, our pancreas is really getting worn out and is no longer able to secrete insulin. Then that late stage diabetic needs to take insulin for the rest of their lives.
Mm-hmm.
That's a point where we never want to get to, and that's
right.
What we're able to see on the very critical glucose tolerance test.
Yes.
To see how much insulin they're actually secreting, how low do we need to go in the carbohydrates, how much insulin resistance are we actually talking about.
Mm-hmm.
It's a beautiful, beautiful map
of
blood sugar and insulin. So I love the way we handle that.
Yeah,
anyway, patting us on the back, Dr.
No, but it's fun. We wish we had, you know, 20 patients a week with that precise problem. You know,
this is the way it should be treated. Yeah,
exactly. And, you know, I think it was Isaac Newton who developed the concept for every reaction, there's an equal and opposite reaction. Or you might say what goes up must come down. And if your blood sugar soars because you're eating sugar, it's going to come back down eventually, but it's probably going to plummet and overshoot the mark. And then you have the reverse of diabetes. You have hypoglycemia or low blood sugar. And we see this all the time when people get their glucose tolerance test. They'll go really high, and then a few hours later, they'll normalize, but then they'll overshoot the mark, and they'll go very low. And then they'll feel sweaty, hyper, anxious, just brain dead.
All of it.
And those are the symptoms of hypoglycemia, which many people have. That may be associated with headaches, anxiety attacks, headaches, migraines, any number of health problems are associated with hypoglycemia. So treating hypoglycemia is really fun because
you know,
it's really been about 40 or 50 years since Carlton Frederick started to popularize the notion of hypoglycemia. He wrote very popular books on the subject. The conventional medical establishment still doesn't acknowledge it. And so it's left to us as alternative physicians to turn patients on to this notion to demonstrate that they might have this problem. And when they alter their diet, it really helps. So what you do, the way to treat hypoglycemia, it's similar to what you do to treat metabolic syndrome or prediabetes. You actually have to reduce your insulin, because if your insulin is really high, insulin causes your blood sugar to drop. And if you have very high insulin, it's going to, you know, it's going to continually cause your blood sugar to be too low. So right. If we can lull that insulin back into normalcy by giving patients a relatively low carbohydrate diet or a low glycemic index diet, we even out the ups and downs of blood sugar, then you're less prone to this roller coaster effect.
Yeah.
And it really ultimately helps with symptoms. So, you know, it kind of goes back to this. You know, like you said earlier, a lot of people think, well, if I have low blood sugar, then maybe I should eat some sugar to counteract that.
Oh, well, and that's what doctors were advising back in the 70s.
Well, you know, especially they tell diabetics to make sure you have some sugar pills available, because if you take too much insulin, you could get a hypoglycemic episode. And that actually causes people to have automobile accidents, or sometimes people are found and they look like essentially like they're drug addicts. You know, they're lying there and they're kind of moaning and groaning, and they look like they're drunk or stoned, and they have low blood sugar. And you know, sometimes people just step over them. And that's why, you know, when you see somebody in the subway who looks like they're, you know, just like a druggie, you know, just maybe go up to them and check them out, because they might actually be a diabetic who took too much insulin and they're hypoglycemic. But it's improper to take sugar in if you're a normal person for hypoglycemia, because it's just going to cause your blood sugar to go up and down and up and down, and you're going to perpetuate that merry-go-round.
Exactly. So the answer is really, what does it mean in regard to my eating sweets? It means limit or completely eliminate eating sweets, and the hypoglycemia should right itself. You have to moderate the consumption of carbohydrates,
Right.
Diabetics taking insulin, people taking insulin, do need to have either some glucose tablets on them, or a little bit of orange juice in the house or something for such an emergency. These are special cases, and these are for people taking insulin, because you don't want to go into insulin shock. Yeah.
Right. But even with those patients, we want them on the best possible diet to alleviate the need for so much insulin that they become hypoglycemic all the time.
That's right.
Right. So type 1 diabetics, we also apply some of those principles, although we're more lenient about using sugar if blood sugar gets too low. All right.
Well, the dilemma with type 1 diabetics, and that's the autoimmune diabetes, where the immune system attacks the islets of Langerhans, the beta cells, the pancreas destroys them, and you're no longer making any insulin. Those people are required to take insulin, but it doesn't mean they have to take all that much insulin.
Yes. Mm-hmm.
We still need to make sure that they're taking a consistent amount of carbohydrates, yet a low amount of carbohydrates, because the less insulin they have to administer themselves, the better off they'll be. One of the problems with taking too much insulin is we get fat.
Yep.
Insulin is a fat storage hormone.
Yeah. And whether it's your own insulin or outside administered insulin, you know, so many diabetics, when they start taking their insulin, it turns them into fatties.
We have one case in particular. We have a patient, this gentleman, he lives up in Massachusetts, I remember. Our third consult was a phone consult. He had already dropped 40 pounds.
Yeah.
Because we were able to drop the units of insulin he was administering to me. You know,
oh,
nobody ever told him that.
Yeah.
Not at the Joslin Center, which is renowned for diabetes education. You know, this was, he's doing very well, but this is the way it needs to be treated.
Absolutely. All right.
Okay, off my soapbox.
No, but you're doing great. I mean, there's nothing like hearing you give a lecture on this. It's kind of like, it's like a church revival meeting. I mean, the people just are enraptured, and you feel like, you know, they're just going to jump to their feet and shout, amen, you know, when you're delivering that message. That's the kind of feel that we have at some of these Hoffman Center lectures, that where you talk about issues like blood sugar. We hope we'll replicate that that at our upcoming lecture next Wednesday on the 15th. All right. So here's one from Carolyn. Carolyn writes, "It is terrific to hear you on Saturdays again. We missed you along with all our friends. I am a 66-year-old female presently taking 0.088 of levothyroxine. That's a thyroid medication. My physician just suggested adding iodoral, 12.5 milligrams, once a day in the morning. That's an iodine pill. What do you think of this? I have read conflicting reports on side effects. I am really anxious to hear your opinion. My new blood work shows that the supplements you suggested are keeping everything in terrific shape. My doctor suggested adding the iodine to boost my thyroid medication, as I am feeling very cold and tired, yet my numbers are all normal. Thanks for your time, Carolyn. P.S. I wrote WR and thanked them for putting you back on the radio.
That's terrific.
Thank you, Carolyn. Yeah, we had a, you know, after the torch burning parade in front of WR, with the, you know, when all the people appeared with the pitchforks and the you know, the torchlight thing, they just were totally intimidated and they put me back on the air. That's what.
Hallelujah.
Exactly. Yeah. So let's take a look at this issue. Iodine. That's a very controversial issue when it comes to the thyroid, because iodine is essential for thyroid function.
But it's a double-edged sword, yeah.
It's a double-edged sword. Too much iodine has been shown to either suppress thyroid function or sometimes cause what's called thyroid storm, which is causes the thyroid to get overactive. So this is actually very controversial in the field of complementary and alternative medicine. There's some, you know, there's a debate going on about, should you give a lot of iodine? And some people believe that, there's so much iodine deficiency because we have uniodized salt, and because of the presence of chlorine and fluoride that competes with iodine in the thyroid, that people are critically deficient in iodine. They need a lot of supplementation with iodine. On the other hand, you know, as I said, there's some studies that suggest that iodine, too much iodine, suppresses the thyroid. So what I would suggest for Carolyn is to test her level of iodine and see if she has low levels of iodine. It can be done. We can actually do it. It's a urine test. It's actually a loading test. We give we test before we give iodine in the urine, and then we test after, and we see how much of the iodine is retained by the body and how much spills out. If a lot spills out, it looks like your body doesn't need it that much. If a lot is retained, it suggests your body's very avid for the iodine. It's called the iodine load test. It's not completely accurate, but at least it gives us a heads up on whether you have enough. My concern, though, is she's already taking thyroid medication. Mm-hmm. I think iodine works best when people are not taking thyroid medication. And by the way, when you take iodine, you need to take selenium. It's important to take selenium to protect against the adverse effects of the iodine. If you know, she's on, this goes to the thyroid debate, you know, she's on synthetic thyroid, and it may be that this synthetic thyroid is not doing the job, and her doctor says it looks fine. But I recently saw an episode of Dr. Oz. I don't usually watch Dr. Oz, but I just was flipping around on the TV channels, and he was talking about thyroid, and he had a couple of women in the audience, and he was doing this little demonstration. He was saying, okay, you two women, you switch shoes. You know, one was a size 9 and the other one was a size 6. And he said, you know, you both have normal size feet, right? So it doesn't matter. You switch shoes, you should be fine. Well, of course, the one who was size 6 put on a size 9. She was swimming in it. And the one who was, you know, the other one could barely put the size 6 shoe on her size 9 foot. So he said it's a little bit like that with thyroid. We tend to not customize. We tend to, you know, do a one-size-fits-all. Yes, I know there are different doses of thyroid, but we tend to just look at the TSH as a measure of whether you're on the adequate dose. So if your TSH looks normal but you feel lousy, one of two things could be going on. Either something else is making you feel lousy that hasn't been noted, like a food allergy, or perhaps there's a nutritional deficiency, not enough vitamin D or not enough B12 or something like that. Mm-hmm. The thyroid, the synthetic thyroid, isn't doing the job, and we might switch to a natural thyroid, or we might add some T3 to that T4.
Hmm.
You know, so I, with this gal, Carolyn, it is possible that taking iodine might make her feel better, but I'm not sure.
Yeah. The other thing that I would investigate with Carolyn is, you know, when you take thyroid medication, you want to make sure you're not taking any supplement containing magnesium, calcium, or iron within 3 to 4 hours.
Right.
Of that thyroid medication. And, you know, it really surprises me, Dr. Hoffman, how little people know, they don't know that. They're not told that by their physicians
right.
or anything like that.
Mm-hmm.
Thyroid's supposed to be taken first thing in the morning for the most part. And don't take anything containing calcium, magnesium, iron within 3 to 4 hours because it could dull the effect. Maybe she's taking level thyroxine and then she's taking her multi with her breakfast and the calcium and magnesium in there may be blunting its effect. It might be, I mean, it could be a myriad of things, but these are the first places I would look.
That's
also, what is she eating? What is
right.
she eating? Is she eating a lot of soy?
Sure.
Is she eating too many goitrogens? Is there always kale or raw broccoli in her salad every day, twice a day? I would look at all of these other kind of things a little bit, investigate a little bit,
mm-hmm.
you know, and, Yeah,
because for some people, thyroid is not a one-stop shop. Even if your thyroid's abnormal and you take thyroid and you feel a little better, but you're not feeling 100%, it could be either that you're on the wrong form of thyroid or you're not on enough thyroid, or else there's, you know, it's quite possible that there are other coexisting conditions that haven't been addressed, that it's not just all about the thyroid. So that's my take on Carolyn's
mm-hmm.
situation. You got any more?
Mm-hmm. Actually, yes.
Okay, we have time for one more.
But
yeah, time
for...
really flies when we do these things.
I know.
Where did
the
time go?
Yeah, exactly. This one is from George. He says, 4 years ago, my wife was diagnosed with osteoporosis at a negative 2.9 in the hip.
Okay, that's osteoporosis, yeah.
Yes. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Luckily, I heard Dr. Hoffman talk about strontium, vitamin K, magnesium, in addition to calcium and vitamin D. My wife took these supplements, and her recent bone density scan showed she no longer had osteoporosis. It was at a negative 1.4.
That is so gratifying to hear. That's
it's
great.
It's wonderful to hear that.
We didn't even know this person from Adam, and all of a sudden we see
yeah.
that we've done some good for them just by virtue of our broadcast.
Yeah.
So that's great.
Yeah. And George asks, does Dr. Hoffman usually stop strontium until the next DEXA
yeah.
in 2 years? She's 68 years old.
Good question. You know, and it is easier to make a decision to start the strontium than to make a decision to stop it. I think that strontium is something that is an exceptional nutrient. It is, you know, it's a little bit like using high dose niacin to lower your cholesterol. You know, there's more niacin in a cholesterol pill for lowering cholesterol than you'll get in niacin containing foods. So you're actually using what is called a pharmacological dose. It is a natural thing, but you don't find that much strontium in the average food. So you're using the strontium for its bone strengthening effect. So it's a drug like application of a nutrient. And I'm very conservative. I think that, you know, once the osteoporosis has been addressed, it may be time to take a rest. And I don't think there's a big downside in waiting a couple of years and seeing if the bone density is maintained without the strontium. 1.4 is actually pretty good. It's a dramatic improvement. It is always a possible option to reinstate the strontium, which I've had to do for some patients. You know, we take them off and then sorry about that. You know, you lost some bone. We're starting to move more towards osteoporosis again. Start it again. And I think we need more research and more experience with strontium, because strontium's been used, I would say in Europe, it's been used for probably more than 20 years. In the United States, we've only had access to, over-the-counter natural strontium for about 8 or 10 years. I've been using it nearly that long. And we need to know more about what happens to patients if they take strontium for a long time. Mm-hmm. Is it overkill? Or if they go off, is it harmful? Are they going to lose ground? And I would err on the side of caution. I would say if you've been on it for two or four years and you've seen pretty dramatic improvements, that you can, you know, just like with medication, you know, you've seen the improvement and you can go off. You know, some of the osteoporosis drugs, the ones that I don't particularly like Actonel and Boniva
and
Fosamax, studies show that they are beneficial for the probably about the first 4 to 6 years. But beyond that, the downsides begin to outweigh the benefits. And so Theoretically, that may be the case with strontium, although strontium acts in a different way, and I think in a more benign and natural way than some of these osteoporosis drugs. That's why I prefer it to the drugs, not just because it's natural, but because it has a more physiologic mode of action that is more compatible with the body's natural way of building bone.
And it doesn't cause side effects like the bisphosphonates do, like, you know, esophageal erosion,
yes,
heartburn, GERD, necrosis of the jaw.
Yeah,
I mean, these are all scary things.
Or pathological fractures, which is kind
yes.
of, you know, I actually sometimes I see advertisements, even on TV, sometimes via the internet, you know, have you been taking Boniva, Actonel, Fosamax? Did you experience a fracture? Call, you know, this law firm because we're going to, you know, sue the manufacturers and get a big settlement for you. Because there are, I mean, a minority of women, clearly, but a significant minority are experiencing bad side effects. And it's the point where there are actually lawsuits because of that.
Yeah, yeah. You know, anytime I go to the dentist, I'm always asked, are you on any medication, but particularly bisphosphonates?
That's smart.
Yeah.
But, you know, I've actually caught women who are on those medications and they say, oh, I'm going for dental implants. I said, are you kidding? You're going for dental implants where they're going to drill into your jaw to put these metal anchors in.
Yeah.
When you're on these medications, I said, you better let your dentist know. Because you could have a terrible result. The whole metal anchor could become loose. There could be tremendous inflammation. You could set off a whole cascade of literally bone death. There's no cure for it. You don't want to traumatize the jaw with extensive dental work when you're on those medications. That to me is very scary.
Yeah. Yeah. Absolutely.
All right. Time is very fleeting.
I think we've
fielded some important questions.
Mm-hmm.
And thanks for making yourself available once again to
thank you for having me
for Q&A with Layla. And we'll keep doing it in 2014. We got lots of questions. Radioprogram@AOL.com gets you on tray with your question or your concern. Keep your queries coming. And don't forget to continue downloading our podcast. Now we have a live radio program on Saturdays. You can hear it in its entirety from 12 to 2, noon to 2 on Saturdays. And subscribe to our newsletter because we'll give you the heads up on how to get all this connectivity. We'll have a new website coming up later this month, and that'll make it a lot easier to listen to podcasts and to even listen live on Saturdays. Thanks for joining us, Layla.
Thank you.
I'm Dr. Ronald Hoffman, and this is the Intelligent Medicine Podcast. You've just listened to a free podcast brought to you by yours truly and the Hoffman Center. F-R-E-E is my favorite four-letter word, but these podcasts do involve time and money to produce. And so in the spirit of defraying some of our very real production costs and to keep these podcasts flowing, I'd like to ask you to consider a couple of things. First, if you like what you're hearing, please share these podcasts with your friends and relatives. Our object is to continue the spectacular growth of the Intelligent Medicine Podcast with the goal of attaining 250,000 podcast downloads per month in 2014. I know that with the help of dedicated listeners like you, it'll happen. Second, go to drhoffman.com and click on the store and consider buying your supplements via a convenient internet portal or call the Hoffman Center and talk to one of our friendly supplement advisors. We only stock the very highest quality supplements, some of which are very hard to find elsewhere, the very same supplements that I talk about here on Intelligent Medicine and that I prescribe to my patients at the Hoffman Center. And finally, consider becoming a patient at the Hoffman Center. I can personally perform an extensive workup on you, applying all the intelligent medicine principles that you hear about on these podcasts, or alternatively, make an appointment with Layla Mutin, our Hoffman Center nutritionist. You already know her as a frequent contributor on intelligent medicine, and she'll provide you with expert advice on diet and supplements. Anyway, thanks for listening and continue enjoying our Intelligent Medicine podcasts.